towards liberation. Thank you so much for all you do and for spending this time with me.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Ruthie Wilson-Gilmore, and she is a professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences and American Studies and the director of the Center for Place, Culture, and Politics at CUNY Graduate Center. She's co-founded many grassroots organizations, including the California Prison Moratorium Project, Critical Resistance, and more. And again, we've been talking about her new book, just out by Verso, Abolition Geography, Essays Towards Liberation. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com. By becoming a subscriber, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on Facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on Twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2H2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Tune in to KBOO on Monday, January 16th at 1 p.m. for the live broadcast of the 38th Annual Martin Luther King Jr. Tribute. This annual tribute event at the Highland Christian Center features stage performances and speakers, including Danelle Damon and Greater Works Choir. That's the live broadcast of the 38th Annual Martin Luther King Jr. Tribute, broadcasting from the Highland Christian Center on Monday, January 16th from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Welcome to another episode of Civic Cypher. I'm your host, Ramses Ja.
He is Ramses Ja. I am Q Ward, and you are tuned into Civic Cypher.
Yes, you are. And we got a lot for you to stick around for. Today, we're going to be talking about some stuff that comes up in life. And in particular, the past couple of weeks, we've had to have some really strange conversations. And we've also kind of encountered some stuff on the internet that let us know that common sense is not all that common.
Not even kinda.
Yeah, yeah. And that's okay, because we're here to learn. So we're not picking anybody apart. We're not, you know, trying to tear anybody down. But again, stay tuned. We're going to be talking about this strange question, you know, are white people smarter than black people? Or are black people less intelligent than white people? You know, and there are people who sincerely feel like they have the full story because they have test scores or, you know, whatever it is that they think that they have to kind of validate that belief. And we're going to talk about that today. We're also going to talk about what we call code switching, but basically we're going to talk about how black people in this country are inherently bilingual. I think that was something that I heard a comedian say that's once upon a time.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. So we have to, you know, I heard a non-black woman recently said that when she was growing up, black people used to speak jive to her.
Jive.
Yeah, so that tells you when she's
from. Shout out to the 70s.
Yeah, man.
And so, the 60s.
And shout out to Cheryl. She's a sweetheart. And we got a whole lot more for you to stick around for as well. But first and foremost, we'd like to start at the top with what we like to call Ebony Excellence. Q?
Shall we?
We shall. All right. So this week's Ebony Excellence is sponsored by Hip Hop Weekly Media. And the article comes from Marine Times. It's not a subject we talk about all that often on the show. So,
you know, taking any too many dives.
Yeah, in the military.
Marine times.
So, the article reads, one Marine will make Corps history by becoming the first black woman to serve as a two-star general in the service. President Joe Biden appointed Brig Gen Lorna Maylock to the grade of Major General, the Pentagon announced on December 6th, and the Senate confirmed her recently. Maylock is the Deputy Director of Cybersecurity for Combat Support at the National Security Agency at Fort Meade, Maryland. Born in Kingston, Jamaica, Maylock immigrated to Brooklyn, New York at the age of 17 in 1985. According to a biography written by Marquette University, she enlisted in the Marine Corps 3 months later and became an air traffic controller. She received her commission through the Women Marines Association. She has amassed multiple higher degrees, including two master's degrees in strategic studies from the U.S. Army War College and the Naval Postgraduate School, Marine Corps Times previously reported. Maylock was nominated to the grade of Brigadier General in 2018, and she became the first Black woman to achieve that rank. One of the smallest military branches, the Marine Corps has the lowest percentage of women among its troops at 9%. Only three women in the Corps history have picked up the rank of Lieutenant General, and all three of them are retired. So today we are going to highlight you and applaud you, Lorna Maylock, for making Black history and for being a shining example of ebony excellence. Keep going.
Brigade General Lorna Maylock.
That's her.
That's incredible.
Indeed it is. So, all right, so let's talk about how smart we are. Isn't that weird? That's a weird thing to talk about.
I talk about how smart Ramses is all the time.
Stop.
I don't think it's very strange at all.
Okay. So we basically for today's segment, we had to pull some back and forth stuff off of the internet just to kind of help paint a picture. But before we get there, I want to get your early thoughts on this topic, Q.
I mean, sure. Go for it.
So
my early thoughts on which topic?
Well, specifically, whether or not Black people are less intelligent than white people or Asian people.
Well, hasn't all the research already proven that we are by far the lesser of the intelligent creatures?
This is sarcasm, ladies and gentlemen. This is sarcasm.
I thought that's what it said.
This is sarcasm. Well, you know what? To your point, Q, if you grew up in the U.S. and you weren't educated in a way that prevents a lot of, how would I describe it? Cultural and let's be honest, white supremacist based ideals to take root in your brain, you might think that, right? I know this is true for me. Once upon a time, I found myself, I always took tests well. You know, I got good marks in class and all that sort of stuff. And eventually they start kind of separating you from the people that are your age mm-hmm. into smaller classes where you have, there's less students and you get more intense education.
Yeah, it's more engaging.
Sure. They call it, when I got to high school, they would call it honors classes, but you know, this has kind of been a story of my life. They would take me out of my normal classroom setting and put me into a special class for gifted kids, right? And every time they did that, I found that there were even less people of color. And that was a norm for, you know, school. You know, that was just kind of normal how it went. And I guess if I were to take that and just accept it as face value, I would think that overwhelmingly white children are more intelligent than Black and brown children, right? But that's not the full story. And it's strange that you're taught that. And it's strange that people push back against things like critical race theory. When I talked about earlier, when I mentioned that white supremacist ideals and institutions that kind of bolster and fortify these notions, they don't, this attack on CRT, which is effectively American history that seeks to tell the whole story and paints a fuller picture so that people get the nuance and they understand, okay, opportunities exist in these areas and they don't exist to the same degree in these other areas. And then you have results that reflect that in society. Without that, you end up kind of like me, just thinking that, oh, this is normal. I am in rare air in this classroom, right? So I'll read a bit from the online conversation that we were having. The question was posed, don't most Black people have lower IQ than whites? And then it goes on to say that, you know, if you believe in evolution, Black folks look different, as do Asians and Caucasians. Evolution doesn't stop with skin pigment. In other words, Black people are less evolved, right? And it's again, maybe these ideas are the result of a person being hateful, ignorant, you know, whatever. But maybe a person who draws a conclusion like this is simply trying to state their reality in plain terms. And they may not question why their reality is the way that it is, which is what we seek to do on this show. Mm-hmm. Why? Were we born to be poor and get beat up by the police? Are we criminal? You know what I mean? Like, you go to Africa, it's not like that, you know? Are we, whatever stereotype you think that is true of Black people, there's different circumstances in this country that shape outcomes. And those circumstances are often overlooked, which is why on this show, at least, we really fought very hard and continue to fight to make sure that the whole story is told and that education includes American history and the origins of the origin story of Black people in this country and everything in between. All right, so we'll go down to the answer, because now that the question is posed. The irony here is extremely painful. Suppressing urge to engage in ad hominem, Thomas Sowell discovered old military mental test results. Now, just so you know, Thomas Sowell is not a person that I'm a big fan of. I don't agree with a lot of his thinking, but just so you know, to give you some context, he's a Black conservative, very educated man, and just has a what I believe to be a flawed belief system, you know. But I wouldn't say that he doesn't love his people. I can't say, he might not, but I don't know that to be true. I just believe that he and I would certainly take different paths to get to the same result. In other words, I'm allowing this moment for him because even a broken clock is right, you know, twice a day. All right, let's go on. Differences in mental test scores among different racial and ethnic groups were taken as proof of genetic differences in innate mental ability during the progressive era in the early 20th century. Progressives regarded the fact that the average IQ test score among whites was higher than the average among Blacks as conclusive proof of genetic determinism, right? So again, if you just take those test scores at face value, well, women lie, men lie, numbers don't lie, right?
That's one way to put it.
Yeah, but as we know, and I wouldn't be talking about this if it weren't true, that's not the whole story. In fact, often enough, when there are numbers, there is a much deeper story there, because we've learned on this show that numbers can be made to look any kind of way, especially if you don't tell the whole story. So I'll continue. A closer look at mental test data, however, shows that there were not only individual Blacks with higher IQs than most whites, but also whole categories of whites who scored at or below the mental test scores of Blacks. All right, let's keep going. Among American soldiers given mental tests during the First World War, for example, white soldiers from Georgia, Arkansas, Kentucky, and Mississippi scored lower on mental tests than Black soldiers from Ohio, Illinois, New York, and Pennsylvania. Okay.
So where by that time, there was access to education. It was okay to learn how to read. It was not still illegal to teach either current or former slaves anything, et cetera, et cetera.
It's a progressive time. And of course, the Black people were from progressive cities, right? And again, the white soldiers from Arkansas, Kentucky, Mississippi, you know what I mean? Their education system may not have matured to the point where it could be competitive with the education system in a big city where the Black folks, you know, scored higher than those white folks. So what you're seeing now is a perhaps geographical correlation with these test scores that is more profound, certainly more striking and more telling than, okay, Black people scored lower, white people scored higher, right? And from this alone, you can see the direction that this is going. And I'm gonna save the rest of this reading just for a bit, but you can draw your own conclusions. And for those who may not be able to draw the conclusions all the way out, I'm going to help. Both Q and I are going to help. So if from that we can agree that where you grow up has an effect on your education, then perhaps there's something to do with the quality of education, right? Because again, in progressive cities, you know, the school systems seem to educate people better than in more rural areas, less developed, you know, states and parts of the country. So again, the quality of the education matters, right? But let's take it a step further. How is education funded? Well, education is funded with property taxes, right? So you pay your property taxes on your house, that goes to your local education, you know, your school board and on, right? So it stands to reason that if you have a neighborhood, we'll call it, you know, or a part of town where it's more affluent, the houses are nicer, taxed at a higher rate, et cetera, schools are nicer, that quality education might be more prevalent in the test scores. It might be reflected in the test score. Meanwhile, on the other side of town where maybe folks are making less money, maybe those people are working longer hours, maybe those people are dealing with other social issues, socioeconomic issues, et cetera, the education received by the students might be inferior. Add to that, you know, I knew a teacher for some years who worked in a rough part of town, and she was a high school too. And she used to ask me, you know, once upon a time, I used to get clothes and shoes given to me because I was on the radio, you know, and the companies would send out boxes of shoes. I'd get five pairs of shoes. I'm not going to wear these. They send me a bunch of clothes I'm not going to wear, all in my size. And I would donate a lot of these to this teacher. Well, she just asked me for it because I was, if I'm honest, probably bragging one day, like, man, I got all this stuff. I'm never going to wear it. And she says, give it to me. I can give it to my students. And she said, in particular, I have one student who has to wear the same thing every day. And he's embarrassed to come to school. So he doesn't come because he only has, you know, he won't tell me about his home life because he's worried that it'll get worse. So I don't know his circumstances, but I know he's always hungry and he always wears the same clothes. And so I says, yes, absolutely. Here you go. Right. And that turned into me giving more, and really it turned into her having a conversation with me. And she says, Ramses, a lot of the students that I teach are constantly in survival mode. That is their reality. 100% of it is survival mode. They don't have room for education. They don't care what the you know, the Pythagorean theorem of, you know, a triangle and the isosceles and, the, you know, none of that. They don't care about any of that. They worry about where they're going to eat because they didn't eat yesterday and they're hungry right now and they can't focus. And they spent all last night crying and they haven't been home in 4 days, right? And it's not every student that comes from that environment, but it's a lot more
far
prevalent.
Too many. It's right. Not, it's not one or two, you know right. What I mean? Like, it's not every, but it's a lot.
Right. And she believed, just like the United Negro College Fund, that a mind is a terrible thing to waste. And she saw the potential in these students because she was a teacher. She could see that they had the base level intelligence upon which you can build a brilliant mind. It just needed the knowledge. The framework was all there, but she couldn't pour into a mind that wasn't focused and that was hungry. You know, your brain is a funny thing. I had to learn this, you know, partially through her, but, you know, my own studies kind of revealed a lot of this to me. And that's that, you know, your mind is built to protect itself. Your mind will protect itself even if you are under attack. Your physical body is under attack. Your mind will just turn off to protect itself from getting damaged. And you need to be awake. You know what I mean? Your mind will, it's a higher functioning part of you. It's the mind brain. And if that's not in alignment with your agenda, then you're going to lose that fight 100% of the time, right? So with that said, we can still recognize that environment and resources have a lot to do with this, right? If we're using test scores as the metric, okay? Let's also account for the fact that in other parts of the world, they center education very differently than we do in this country.
Yes, indeed.
Right? Education is of the utmost importance in other parts of the world, in particular in Southeast Asia, East Asia and Southeast Asia, where, you know, their test scores are often compared to the scores of, you know, U.S. students. And
then typically higher across the board, regardless of race or gender.
Sure. And again, that is a reflection of some cultural differences there. Bear in mind that in this country, the education system, I'm drawing from memory now, but the education system was largely built as a result of John D. Rockefeller's expansion of his empire in New York City. He needed workers to build those skyscrapers. And those workers had to have certain skills, certain knowledge. And this is where you get the beginnings of standardized testing. You know, once upon, you think of Little House on the Prairie, there was a schoolhouse, all the kids were in the same school, all different ages and grades or whatever, all doing the same thing. Well, John D. Rockefeller comes along and says, look, man, I need people to know these skills so that, you know, these buildings are built properly.
Who amongst you can do this?
Right.
Okay, I need all y'all to come with me.
Right, exactly. And he partnered with the Board of Education, or really established the Board of Education in the New York, which was then replicated elsewhere in the country to where we ended up with what we have now. This wasn't always the case. It's always been the case in our lifetime, sure, but it wasn't the case since the 1600s. That just isn't the way this has come about. And, you know, the result of that is that the education system had to be built around seasonal work. A lot of young people still had to go in the summers and harvest with their families because a lot of people, you know, work in farms. This is why we get summers off. And in other countries, they don't. They go to school year round. You know, they treat school like it's work. Not like it's something that you have to do in order to, you know, not go to jail. It's work. You work hard and you create opportunities for yourself, right? And a lot of these places, when you get out, you don't even have those opportunities. Like, you know, this is the land of opportunity. They're the land of education. And it's strange how that kind of fleshed out. But again, we're talking about test scores, which is the, I guess, the accepted method of determining who's smart and who's not. So it's a lot trickier than...
It's a simple method. It's an unsophisticated...
Very, very overly simplified
unsophisticated method of trying to determine who's smart and who's not.
So let me jump back in and read a little bit more here. Among other groups of whites, those with average mental test scores no higher than the average mental test scores among blacks included those in various isolated mountain communities in the United States. Those living in the Hebrides Islands off of Scotland and those in isolated canal boat communities in Britain. Looking at achievements in general, people living in geographically isolated environments around the world have long lagged behind the progress of people with a wider cultural universe, regardless of the race of the people in these isolated places. When the Spaniards discovered the Canary Islands in the 15th century, they found people of a Caucasian race living at a Stone Age level. And then the conversation here goes on. I just want to read this because I think it's pretty cool. That's all I'm willing to give you on this question. Using common sense, you will only be able to determine this properly if everyone is equally given a good education that is consistent across the board and over a substantial period of time. And I don't think we have ever seen that. There are definitely many, many, many black people with higher IQs than you. I like the sass at the end of that. But also,
I like the end of that too.
Yeah, it was petty in a perfect kind of way.
Very specifically petty.
But you know, this is something that's a lot of people need to challenge themselves, because I know that you've heard this cue and I've heard it certainly. You know, I like you. It's your people.
I've heard.
Oh,
those
you
words.
You talk.
I've heard those words specifically. Like sure. Those exact words that you said.
I believe it. And you know, oh, you why you talk so nice? Why can't everybody you know talk like you? Why don't your people talk like you?
That I had to give an example of a conversation like that to a white coworker today. Right, that we end up in these rooms where that's the conversation that we're being had, and we talk about the oversimplification of determining who's smart. Mm. I heard someone say it, I can't credit the right person because it's not top of mind right now, but if you judge the intelligence of a fish on its ability to fly, then every fish would fail.
And it would spend his whole life thinking it's stupid. And this is an injustice to 6-year-old Ramses, having lived a life thinking that we were just supposed to be poor, and you know, I was a person that I don't know, got luck. Who knows?
We're gonna give you guys more on this topic. I want us to look over this interview that Neil deGrasse Tyson did, just on the basis of racism and anthropology. So we'll follow up on that on another episode.
Yeah, actually, I'm pretty excited to do that as well.
And now. Proper propaganda.
Watch it. Pull my mic back. You like that? Journalists, we're journalists too. We can strike back. Hardcore reporters with orders from headquarters. Behind enemy lines, sidestepping the borders.
If you're just tuning in to Civic Cypher, I am your host, Ramses Ja.
He is Ramses Ja. I am Q Ward. You are listening to again, but thank you for this. Civic Cypher.
Yeah, we do appreciate you tuning in every week, man. We're trying to do something for you, and it seems like you're trying to do something for yourself and for your community and for your brothers and sisters who may or may not look like you. That goes a long way in my book. I will see you in heaven. Stick around, because we got a lot more show coming up for you, including code switching. That is what I said earlier, basically kind of covered it. Black people are in this country are bilingual. And you may not have knew it. And you might know it if you've been around a black person long enough or in different circumstances, but we're gonna spend some time talking about that. We're also gonna discuss our Way Black History Fact. Today we're gonna talk about a white man named Benjamin Lay for our Way Black History Fact. And if you think that sounds interesting, wait until you hear the story. But first and foremost, we're gonna show you, or rather tell you, how to become a better ally. It's time for BABA, Baba. And today's Baba is brought to you by Major Threads Sportswear. Check out majorthreads.com for the finest in men's sportswear. Today, to become a better ally, we want you to read a book. The book is called How White Folks Got So Rich, The Untold Story of American White Supremacy. And basically, it kind of dispels the myth of kind of the pioneer, you know, westward expansion, or you know, the colonists crossing the Atlantic to the New World and making a life for themselves and making a go at it. It largely dispels a lot of myths associated with that way of thinking, because that way of thinking kind of suggests that everyone else is lazy or doesn't work hard or something like that, right? And the truth is there were lots of deliberate, intentional levels in society that, you know, encouraged people to do things, to pioneer, to take over lands, and you were given things and you were able to grow and, you know, transfer wealth from one generation to the next. I'll quickly read a review. How white folks got so rich is a critical and essential information that non-whites need to understand to be able to make sense of how we ended up in the situation we find ourselves in today. Specifically, information people classified as Black need to know and understand. Black adults, and even more importantly, young Black people need to understand how the system of racism and white supremacy has played a major role in how people who classify themselves as white maintain dominance and control through a system of cleverly crafted laws and rules designed to undermine Black progress every step of the way and privilege white people every step of the way. So yeah, check that book out, How White Folks Got So Rich. It is interesting. And again, we're not knocking anybody. We're just trying to tell the truth so that everybody understands why we are where we are. Once we understand that, then we know how to move forward as brothers and sisters. Now, code switching. Q, you ever had to code switch?
Probably not even aware of the amount of time it's just happened without second thought.
Yeah, man.
And I don't think this is, I think most people hear that and they immediately connect it to corporate America or the difference in cultures, but it's the difference between the way you talk at school versus the way you talk at church. It's not just about your Black friends and your white friends or mm-hmm. corporate America versus home. It's your friends versus your mom, your pastor versus your teacher, your football coach versus your, you know, the deacon at your church. It's just all these different forms of not just language, but behavior growing up in this skin, in this country.
Absolutely. There's, it's interesting because, you know, you're right. At church, you wouldn't talk the same way you would, let's say, after school with your friends, you know, growing up. Or if you're, I don't know, hanging out with your buddies, that's not a word I would normally use, but your buddies at a nightclub, you know what I mean? Now everybody can kind of say, well, yeah, I'm gonna like push my tongue out a little further if I'm hanging with my friends versus if I'm in church. That's not what code switching is. Code switching is an entirely different posturing, different tone. You know, you gotta make sure you don't sound too angry, too aggressive. It's basically you're putting on your whitest display.
I'll challenge that, but
in the right settings, you know, in the other ones, it's kind of like,
I'll challenge that, but go ahead.
Well,
I think what you're calling well-articulated speech is white.
So you're right.
I'm putting on your whitest as if to substitute white for professional, well-spoken, articulate. Sure. I have to push back on that.
Please push back on it. So let me finish what I'm saying. And then what you're about to say is very necessary. So we are often taught to be like them, be better than them, to be good enough, right? They hold the opportunities. They're the ones that hire, fire, advance, grade, you know, whatever it is that you're doing in life. And by they, I mean white people. This is the world that we live in, right? And so this is a skill that I believe that Black people develop at a young age, because we recognize that we are, or I guess I should speak for myself. I recognize that if I sound like them and I move like them, then I might be able to fly under the radar. I might get a passing mark. I might, you know, I might not be challenged. I might have an easier go at things. You have no idea the amount of code switching that happens if the police are behind me and they're like, sir, can you step out of the car? Yes, sir. No, sir. You know, absolutely. I don't talk like that. Right. And to call it whitening, making yourself as white as you possibly can, is absolutely the wrong way to describe it. But in when you boil it down to it, I think that it's very easy for Black folks to make a connection with that code switch and whiteness in a vast majority of instances. Like, there is a white presence that is telling me, or that makes this switch preferable if I want certain outcomes here, right? In other words, I may not lean on, as my friend Cheryl would call it, jive talk, interacting with an employer, a person that holds the keys to opportunity, anybody that I need to take me seriously. I could be talking to, you know, someone who's giving me bad service at a restaurant. I could be talking to a manager. I could be, you know, whatever the situation is. You put on your, provided that it's a person that looks white, I could be at the doctor's office. You put on that language, that face, that posture, and try to have that conversation. Now, in contrast, and I do want to hear from you, but let me just wrap this up. In contrast, if I go to a doctor and the doctor is Black, it's not, strictly speaking, necessary. In fact, it might feel a little awkward because you also know, doctor, that I don't talk like this, right? And so there's the potential to have a much more comfortable conversation. This is an experience I had recently. I took my little sister to get her blood drawn for something that she had to take care of medically. And the doctor came in and she was a Black woman, braids, you know, just, and she was like, oh, look at you. And my little sister's name is Princess, right? That's her given name. My dad is a G. Anyway, so the doctor comes in and she's like, your name is Princess? Oh, wow, we're about to have some fun today, girl. You know, and that's, you can't imagine it's hard to explain the rhythm of we about to have some fun today, girl, from a Black woman to another Black woman, and how important and comforting that is. How the doctor didn't have to code switch. The doctor can just kind of stay where she is and get on my sister's level. My sister received that information. She's terrified of needles. She got that blood drawn off, blood draw off, no problem, no tears this time. My sister's an adult woman and it's a really traumatic thing for her. That's why I go with her. Wonderful experience, right? So push back against the whiteness, the thing I've said about whiteness. Go ahead.
So I think the reason why my variance of examples was so different is I'm from Detroit.
Okay. So yeah, everybody's so Black.
I need everybody to hear that. Yeah. I'm from Detroit, born in the 80s.
Yeah.
And not 89, 80, 81, 80. Yeah. So born in the 80s. I lived my whole 80s childhood in Detroit. Teachers, friends, neighbors, pastor, doctor, police officers, dentists,
all
Black.
Yeah.
So even the word code switch means something different to me because right. My change in vernacular, attitude, behavior, and language had nothing to do with your skin color.
Yeah.
I spoke different to Pastor William Reveille, doctor, right? Yeah. Doctor, first of all, that.
Yeah.
My pastor was Dr. William Reveille.
Yeah.
My associate pastor was Reverend Estella Seacrest, who, for people who listen to the show a lot, know that's my mother.
Yeah.
The way I spoke to them was much different than the way I spoke to everybody else.
Sure, sure.
So that change was more about respect of position, respect of place than skin color.
Yeah.
I spoke different to my doctor, my pastor, my teachers than I did, like I said, my football coach, my classmates, and mm-hmm. my friends.
Yeah.
So it was never about being more white.
It's a respect thing.
It was
in
just
a lot
more
of
about
instances.
Where am I
and who am I talking
what
to?
Type of impression do I need to make here? If there I'm trying to get a job, I'm going to let these people know that I'm learned, yeah. that I'm a scholar, that I'm educated.
And I that can articulate mean, my thoughts.
Yeah. So that didn't mean I'm going to talk like my white friend because I didn't have any.
Yeah.
There was no white example.
Yeah.
Mr. Wardell, who taught me math, and Miss Moy was Asian. Mr. Wardell was Black. They were just smart. My brain didn't think that means they're more like white people.
Sure.
Right. And fortunately, the white people in my life at that age were also teachers. So they just were people that cared about me. There was not even that. I mean, these teachers, they didn't just work in Detroit. They lived in the city too. Mm-hmm. So the experience was very, very much about the students in the classroom, not like the idea of the white savior didn't even play a part.
Yeah.
Because the teaching staff was diverse, but predominantly Black as well. Because again, Detroit, Michigan, my first white classmate was at Cass Technical High School my freshman year, but that was almost singular. I didn't have classrooms full of white students until Bowling Green State University. And I think I've told the story of my first
year in college.
Actual encounter with flagrant, overt racism.
Sure.
And then, of course, that, you know, that turns into a snowball and you start to experience it more as an adult. But there was a kind of sheltering of growing up in Detroit with a best friend in high school who moved to Detroit from Gary, Indiana. Yes, Jackson 5, Gary, Indiana, right? So
that's the hood.
Yeah. So all of our experiences, the lawyers, the doctors, the and every type of doctor, your PhD, your MD, your sociologist, your psychologist, your dentist, everybody was all Black.
Mm-hmm.
Your pastors, your principals, your assistant principals, the people who ran the Jesuit high school that you had to test to get into, mm-hmm. from Cass Tech to Martin Luther King to Renaissance, Black people. So that's my pushback on the idea that this behavior was about being more like white people, not for us.
Not, yeah, yeah.
It had nothing to do with that.
So
like, absolutely nothing. It was about, okay, you're about to go talk to Doctor.
Yeah, you got it.
Reverend, Mr., whatever name came after that,
mm-hmm.
you need to straighten up.
Yeah.
Put your pants up, tuck your shirt in.
It's about to
use proper language.
Yeah.
Be respectful. If you want to receive respect, you have to give it, and you have to present yourself as respectable, not as white.
You sound like an athlete.
You know what I mean?
You sound like you learned these.
Much different experience for me than maybe some people who grew up in a space where what articulate and educated looked and sounded like was white.
Sure, sure. But I think that your example, what it does is it suggests what our initial statement was, is that we're, when you grow up Black in America, you grow up bilingual. Because I know you've heard this. Man, you guys talk so cool. Man, can you explain what the lyrics of that rap song means? What is it? You know, like, what is a bando? You know, like that sort of stuff, right? You talk so cool, right? So, again, having to, like, I know for a fact that if you were to take the type of conversation that you would have with your friends in high school and try to have that conversation in front of your mom, she might get lost at maybe 3 or 4 points of the conversation, like, well, okay, I missed that. Well, you know, through context clues, you can get still a majority of it, but there's certain parts where they get lost. This happened with my father, because we would often leave here, go to Los Angeles. Me and my friends from high school, we go to Los Angeles, hang out with my father, and he would get lost in our conversations. He'd be like, man, the way you guys talk is so different. My father is as Black as me, right? But again, that illuminates the fact that, yes, there is sort of a bilingual component to being Black that is not readily found in every other culture, right? With that said, for places where it's not as monocultural, like a place like Detroit, an environment where it's kind of mixed up a bit, think California, you know, which is where I'm from, and where you think of a lot of the people who are in positions of authority, how do they move? How do they sit? How do they talk? You know, your examples come from classrooms often enough, and the news, when you see these people, and they all look white and they all talk like this, they say the whole word like this, to quote Riley from the Boondocks. And you realize that you're playing a game in their world where they make the rules and they are the deciders at the end of the day. And so this code switching becomes more important as you mature. But I think from a young age, a lot of us recognize that having those two languages and knowing when to deploy them in conversations can make a significant impact on outcomes in your life. Now, I do want to read something here. So the question was, why do Black people switch the sound of their voice to sound white when speaking to white people? Okay, This is the question that was asked. And the answer was, it's an example of outstanding soft skills as masters of customer service within an assimilated integrationist token environment. The technique of mimicking the customer's cadence, tone, and accent is used to help alleviate the stereotype-based terror white people feel when they speak to Black people. In other words, we don't want you to feel intimidated, afraid. We don't want you to feel like we're going to mess things up for you. Now, that sort of stuff, right? So this response is speaking to those parts of it, right? Which may not be true 100% of the time for 100% of the people, but it kind of gives you some insight into the necessity of being bilingual while being Black in this country, right? I'm talking to you on the radio right now. I realize that I have to have an intellectual conversation on the radio every week. I don't talk like this. Man, I am the coolest dude in the world. Man, if you just listen to me on the show, you think I'm as square as that CD cover in the corner. But I also recognize that this is something that has come very natural for me. You know, I might code switch 6 or 8 times in a day, depending on how many people I'm around.
I actually got to tell our audience, I need to work with Ramses on his code switch, though.
What do you mean?
Because sometimes there's very, very necessary code switch.
Oh, and I don't do it. And I don't do it.
And Ramses, forgive my language, be tripping.
Yeah.
I'd be having to re-text Ramses like, bro, did you really just mean to say that to that person again? And he's like, yeah, man, they're cool. And I'm like, I don't know if she's that cool. Like, I don't know if that's how we want to address anyway.
Important people.
We got off track, yeah, but that's Ramses be tripping. Again, Ramses is from Compton. So let me remind the audience. Q is from Detroit, right? 7 Mile Road to be specific. Ramses Jai is from Compton. I'll let you guys do your own mental math on culturally what these conversations sound like when the microphones are not here.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think to piggyback off of the first part of the show, Q and I are both people that were in classes for smart kids, and you know, we took tests well, and we can articulate our thoughts better than most people. I hope that doesn't sound like we're bragging, but this is something that we found to be true, and we try to use this what we consider gifts to kind of give people insight into what it's like to be us. To give you a little bit more firsthand knowledge of something you may not otherwise be made aware of, and having the ability to articulate these things, we feel like it might translate. And so, sometimes that switching is definitely necessary. And then sometimes you're right, I just don't do it.
Ramses be tripping.
But you know, there's another part of it too. And I think that this is something that, now that we're here, is worth mentioning. Code switching I know in my heart of hearts, it's not a betrayal of who I am. It's not a betrayal of my people, my culture, my ancestors. That's not it. Communicating takes place in a lot of ways. Just because someone else says, you know, the King James version of English is the way to get an idea out of your head into someone else's head, doesn't make them right, doesn't make you right, doesn't make anyone right. Communication is, can I get a thought from my head into your head? And if I can do that, then we are communicating. I'm not the best Spanish speaker, although it was the first language I spoke. I have a grandmother, my grandmother's from Cuba. She raised me the first few years of my life. If you were to drop me off in the middle of Mexico, I'd sound like a 3-year-old talking to anybody. But am I communicating? Yes, absolutely. I could get myself to a phone booth. I can get myself to a station where there's people that can help me. I can get myself a ticket and get back to the US, right? Or get myself a translator. That's communicating. If someone has an accent that you don't love, it's an accent. It in no way is a reflection of their cognitive abilities. Some people have brilliant minds and they're not the best speakers. Or some people have brilliant minds and they are the best speakers. They just don't speak in a way that you're accustomed to listening. And these are things that we all have to challenge, because for a long time, I had stereotypes about people that came from the South. And I thought that people from the South were just slow. And that's not true. They're just Southern. They have a different way of talking. They're not in a rush to get the thoughts out of their brain. They can sort of take their time a bit and let the words lean on top of each other. And once I learned that, I felt like, oh, maybe I'm misjudging. Maybe I'm being prejudiced, you know? And this is something that we all may be guilty of at different points in our life. So if you happen to come across a Black person that hasn't code switched in your presence, maybe they're trying to let you know who they really are. Maybe they're trying to bring you over to their side of things. Maybe they're trying to make you feel comfortable with their authentic self. And sometimes I be tripping, and sometimes I be trying to make people feel a little bit more comfortable. Let me finish reading this. Okay. The alleviate the stereotyped based terror white people feel when they speak to Black people. Okay. Many times, however, despite our best efforts, the customer will still attack and kill the customer service tech due to self-inflicted anti-Black racism being stronger than civility. In other words, if you hear this example, forgive me for not providing the proper context here, but this example came from obviously a customer service example of a Black person at work having to communicate, right? This could be in a store, this could be over the phone, whatever. It's kind of like the same thing when you hit a call center and you can tell that the person, based on their accent, is from India. You might think they don't know what they're talking about. It's a very natural thing to think if you were raised to think that people off of the news speak the right way. The question you should be asking yourself, however, now and in the future is, can I understand what they are saying to me? And if the answer is yes, that means they are communicating. And at that point, you need to check your prejudices. All right, so it's time for the Way Black History Fact. Today's Way Black History Fact is sponsored by the Black Information Network Daily Podcast. And as I mentioned, we're going to be talking about a gentleman named Benjamin Lay. So let's get started. January 26th, 1682. Through February 8th, 1759. Wow, that was a while ago. Benjamin Lay was an Anglo-American Quaker humanitarian and abolitionist. That means he was white. He worked as a sailor. He's best known for his early and strident anti-slavery activities, which would culminate in dramatic protest. He was also an author, farmer, vegetarian, and distinguished by his early concern for the ethical treatment of animals. Born in England into a farming family, his early trade was as a shepherd and a glove maker. After becoming a Quaker, he worked as a sailor, and in 1718 moved to Barbados. Here, he witnessed the poor treatment of African slaves that instilled in him his lifelong abolitionist principles. Lay later settled in Philadelphia and was made unpopular among his fellow Quakers by his confrontational anti-slavery stance. He published several pamphlets on social causes during his lifetime and one book, All Slave Keepers That Keep the Innocent in Bondage, Apostates, one of the earliest North American works against slavery. Oh man. Lay stood barely 4 feet tall, referring to himself as Little Benjamin. He was a hunchback with a protruding chest, and his arms were as long as his legs. He was a vegetarian. He only ate fruits, vegetables, and honey, and drank only milk and water. He did not believe that humans were superior to non-human animals and created his own clothes to boycott the slave labor industry. He would not wear anything nor eat anything made from the loss of animal life or provided by any degree of slave labor, refusing to participate in what he described as his tracks as a degraded, hypocritical, tyrannical, and even demonic society. Lay was committed to a lifestyle of almost complete self-sustenance after his beloved wife died. My man.
I hope people realize how difficult it was to live that lifestyle
back then. Yeah, I bet. He sounds like an amazing person, though. That's why we're talking about him today. It's the Way Black History Fact, mind you. Go ahead, Benjamin Lay. All right. He first began advocating for the abolition of slavery when in Barbados he saw an enslaved man commit suicide rather than be hit again by his owner. His passionate enmity of slavery was partially fueled by his Quaker beliefs. Lay made several dramatic demonstrations against the practice. He once stood outside a Quaker meeting in winter with no coat and at least 1 foot bare and in the snow. When passersby expressed concern for his health, he said that slaves were made to work outdoors in winter dressed as he was. On another occasion, he kidnapped the child of slaveholders temporarily to show them how Africans felt when their relatives were sold overseas. That is a gangster move.
Indeed.
The most notable act occurred in Burlington, New Jersey, at the 1738 Philadelphia Yearly Meeting of Quakers. Dressed as a soldier, he concluded a diatribe against slavery, quoting the Bible, saying that all men should be equal under God, by plunging a sword into the Bible containing a bladder of a blood-red pokeberry juice, which splattered over those nearby. So he had a flair for the dramatic as well. Okay, this next part comes from this. I pulled some of this from Wikipedia, just so you know my source. This next part comes from a Smithsonian Magazine article, which regarded the Burlington Quaker meeting incident. Okay, so you might hear some stuff again because two different sources. All right. He finally rose to address this gathering of weighty Quakers. Many friends in Pennsylvania and in New Jersey had grown rich on Atlantic commerce, and many bought human property. To them, Lay announced in a booming voice that God Almighty respects all people equally, rich and poor, men and women, white and black alike. He said that slave keeping was the greatest sin in the world and asked, how can a people who profess the golden rule keep slaves? He then threw off his great coat, revealing the military garb, the book, and the blade. A murmur filled the hall as the prophet thundered his judgment. Thus shall God shed the blood of those persons who enslaved their fellow creatures. He pulled out a sword, raised the book above his head, and plunged the sword through it. People gasped as the red liquid gushed down his arm. Women swooned. To the shock of all, he splattered blood on the slave keepers. He prophesied a dark, violent future. Quakers who failed to heed the prophet's call must expect physical, moral, and spiritual death. The room exploded into chaos, but Lay stood quiet and still like a statue, a witness remarked. Several Quakers quickly surrounded the armed soldier of God and carried him from the building. He did not resist. He had made his point. The article also describes Lay throwing tobacco pipes at fellow Quakers at meetings in Philadelphia while loudly protesting the slave labor upon which the tobacco growing relied. At other Quaker meetings, whenever anyone who owned slaves stood up to talk, which is how Quaker meetings work, he'd jump up and yell things like, "There's another N-word master," to shame them. He regularly said slave owners bore the mark of the beast and were basically Satan incarnate. It came as no surprise to Lay or anyone else that ministers and elders had him removed from one gathering after another. Indeed, they appointed a constabulary to keep him out of meetings all around Philadelphia, and even that wasn't enough. After he was tossed into the street one rainy day, he returned to the main door of the meeting house and lay down in the mud, requiring every person leaving the meeting to step over his body. Lay was disowned by the Quaker Society in 1738 because he just wouldn't stop calling out elders as rich members for their hypocrisy on the issue of slavery. Also that year, Benjamin Franklin published one of Lay's anti-slavery pamphlets, All Slave Keepers That Keep the Innocent in Bondage, Apostates. But Franklin owned a slave and later bought two more. Lay called him out. Lay refused to eat or wear anything produced in any way from slavery. He was a vegetarian and his wife died. He lived in a cave, kept goats and bees, farmed vegetables and fruit trees, and grew flax so he could spin it to make his own clothes. And he had a library of about 200 books. So I think that's kind of partially some way black history for you. And Baba as well, becoming a better ally, because that guy was risking it all 4 feet of him.
And not just risking it, but going to astronomical lengths.
Yeah, sure.
To minimize his impact on,
is to be the example.
The entire industry of the country at that time was sure on the backs of black people.
Yeah.
So that's why I said at that time to be semi-vegan or to not wear cotton.
Take that stance. Yeah.
There was no, you know, artificial, there wasn't a store you can go to where you could buy clothes that weren't either animal or slave work.
Yeah, that's fair.
So to eat and dress and live in that manner at that time far more difficult than it sounds.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people it's in vogue to live like that now because we have so many options. They didn't exist then.
Fair point. Well, if no one else remembers Benjamin Lay, we're definitely going to do it today.
One time.
And that'll be it for us today here on Civic Cypher. So once again, I'm your host, Ramses Ja.
This Ramses and Q, man. I don't know what you want me to say.
Q word, man. That'll work.
Okay. Q word. I'm sorry.
Indeed. The man, the myth, the legend.
Okay. Don't let Ramses gash y'all up.
Nah, man. He's big facts over here. Anyway, we want to thank you for listening to the show. Do us a favor. Hit the website, civiccypher.com. Download this and any previous episodes. Make a donation to the show. We keep growing. It's because of you.
Mm-hmm.
We got more announcements coming your way as well. If you missed any shows, go ahead and download any previous episodes. We're on all the podcasting platforms. Tap in with us on social media. We are at Civic Cypher on all social media platforms. Talk to us as well. Send us feedback, share the content, let us know what you want us to cover. We will do our best to empower you to create the best ally that we can out of you. And we promise you that we are going to be your brothers on the other side of that, into the future. So until next week, y'all.
Peace.
Hey yo, we handle it. These brothers are fabulous. Dilated, showing you where rhyme travel is. Worlds are spit tunes from sunlight to moon. Bussing off stage like gunfight saloons. Pull my mic back, you like that? Journalists, we're journalists too. We can strike back. Hardcore reporters with orders from headquarters. Behind enemy lines, sidestepping the borders. With press passes, we bring it to you as it happens. The streets love my crew for music and rapping. Street commander / beat expander. Here to fight the slander with the proper propaganda. What's happening? You got a question, then ask it. The news is just a TV show, get past it. And this from a quiet wartime journalist. Headlines, wake up, refuse, and resist.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
Hey, Michael here. I'm with the Tin Can Phone Podcast, a radio show where you can hear about the influence incarceration has straight from the source. We tell you the story from the inside out, so make sure to check us out on KBOO.